Moncrief on News Talk.
Yes, indeed. It is time for Moncrief's Murder Club. And as ever, Cassie Delaney is here to guide us through some very strange criminal cases. And today we're talking about cases that all involve twins. Cassie, good afternoon.
How are you, Sean?
Now, twins are fascinating. There's something kind of, I don't want to be offensive to any twins listening, but twins can be a bit kind of creepy.
My theory on twins is it's only okay when you're a child. When you get to adulthood, it's just weird. You just shouldn't have them, especially the twins who dress the same. And this week, I've got three of many stories I could have given you about twins who go into crime either together consciously or unbeknownst to each other, separately, both get involved in criminal activity.
Yeah, it's so strange. So the first one, we're in Yemen. In the early 60s.
So this is where the British Armed Forces kept a base. It's in 1963 in April. And these two twins end up becoming an incredibly well-known pair because, as we get into it, they end up in Broadmoor, which is, I don't know if you know much about it, but it's a horrendous place where it's a wealth of mad stories. So we're in Yemen, as you said. It's a small community of families doing their best to make somewhere alien feel like home. And you've got Gloria and Aubrey Gibbons. They're part of this small community. Aubrey is in the RAF and Gloria gives birth to twin girls named June and Jennifer. Everything's going well so far. The family, of course, given the nature of Aubrey's job, move around a lot the way that service families kind of do. And eventually they settle in Pembrokeshire, which is a small small town on the west coast of Wales in the 1970s. Now, it's worth noting the Gibbons family are one of the very few black families in the area. The twins are the only black children in their school, so immediately bullying starts. It's race-based, and there's other elements to it as well. The girls are very, very close. And in the way that siblings sometimes do, or like best friends do as children, they develop this kind of private language that only they can understand. It's described as being a speech that's very compressed and accelerated. But this really alienates them from the other children and teachers can't understand them. So classmates start mocking them when they can't understand what they're saying. And the girls decide to do something very committed here in that they just stop talking entirely. So they go completely silent to everyone except for each other, their own family included. They develop these kind of rituals that are baffling to any medical professionals and psychiatrists. They walk in perfect synchronization. They mirror each other's steps identically, which, as you can imagine, would be very, very creepy. They cannot bear to be in the same room without moving as one. So if they're forced apart, they can have had these signs of distress and they became very, very codependent on each other. Doctors tried to separate them, send them to different schools, and Jennifer would stop eating. June would stop moving. So within weeks, they are returned to each other and they kind of come back to themselves or what they were known to be. But June and Jennifer, who will say nothing to a living soul outside the family, are writing consistently, furiously. And their work is actually described as quite compelling. So inside their bedroom, they fill it with these notebooks of fiction, novels, stories. And they actually produce a novel. Jennifer produces a novel called The Pepsi Cola Addict, which is strangely very compelling and a well-regarded book, oddly sexually charged. But they are considered, they're starting to kind of build this sort of reputation as maybe being artists. Then everything goes amiss when two American brothers arrive into the neighborhood. So Wayne and Marmaduke Kennedy. Have you ever heard a more American name than Marmaduke Kennedy? It sounds like the name of a dog from a movie. They are expats, roughly the same age as the twins, but they have kind of access to drink and drugs and a social life that the girls had never experienced. So for the first time, the girls are kind of opening this door cautiously, but they get carried away a little bit very quickly. So they're drinking, they're sniffing glue, there's petty theft then, and of course, there is sex amongst teenagers. And then this kind of volatile relationship sort of appear between the two girls. They start to fight over the boy's attention. And they start to fight physically. One would try to strangle the other. The one would hit back. And then they would make up and be inseparable again. But it's just this weird moment of tension that started in their teenage years. But then things escalate. And in 1981, the twins go on a crime spree arson, vandalism, petty theft. They set fire to buildings. The damage runs into hundreds of thousands of pounds. And when they're caught, a psychiatrist assesses them and recommends they can be committed rather than imprisoned. So by 1982, aged just 19, June and Jennifer become the youngest women ever admitted to Broadmoor Hospital, which is the highest security psychiatric institution that has housed some of the most dangerous and notorious criminals Britain has ever seen. During their time, like Peter Sutcliffe and Ronnie Cray were in there as well. So we're talking about access. They're taken off the streets and given access to these mad serial killers and murderers. So they stay there for 11 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but it gets stranger, right? So what was intended as treatment becomes this sort of trap because they're not dangerous per se. They are strange, but they're locked in this bond so intense that it's consumed all their lives and then put in this institution kind of only becomes stronger. And one of the most disturbing details of this bond is that they had at some point come up with this conclusion that only one of them would be able to survive. That the bond was so strong between them that they couldn't continue on like this. And one, in order for one to survive, another must be sacrificed. And it was Jennifer that decided that she would be the one. So on the 9th of March, 1993, the twins are being transferred from Broadmoor to Caswell Clinic in Wales, which would have been a less restricted facilities. All accounts should have been a good day. But at the beginning of the journey, Jennifer, in the back of the car, rests her head on June's shoulder. And by the time she arrives, Jennifer is dead. She's 30 years old and the cause of death is given as acute myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart, sometimes replicates the feeling of a heart attack. But there's no external cause established, no toxicology reports to find anything. Her heart simply stopped beating in the back of the car. So a journalist, Marjorie Wallace, who had known the twins for years and had written about their story extensively, says that June told her Jennifer had known it was coming and that they had arranged between them that June had not wanted it and begged Jennifer not to, but that Jennifer had made it her choice.
Wow.
Yeah, so strange.
And I'm going to die, so... And is it known why they seem to come to this conclusion that only one of them could survive?
No, I have no idea where it came from, but it seemed to be one of those things that was reinforced by the sheer fact that they rarely spoke to each, rarely spoke to other people. They were really only reinforcing their beliefs within themselves.
Mm.
So just... you know, a kind of a compounded interest or something that they just, one of those kind of hyper-fixated thoughts they couldn't get away from.
But they were able to turn it into an actual physical result.
Yeah, but and how, we don't know. So presumably there was something consumed that would induce this myocarditis. But like myocarditis isn't always fatal either.
Mm.
And the toxicology reports show no sign of poisons or any sort of drug overdose or anything like that, or where they would have accessed something like that, considering they were coming from Broadmoor into another facility.
Yeah. So did June eventually, was she June eventually released?
June was eventually released. She lives quietly now. She's given very few interviews. In 2023, she did one with BBC podcast and she explained kind of a little bit about what had happened. But the story is consistent. We said there, she just wants to live a quiet little life now.
And she's never explained how exactly.
Never explained how exactly it happened. But I don't know that June knew herself how it happened. It seemed to be a decision Jennifer had made and stuck to.
How extraordinary. How extraordinary. Right. Again, we're in England for this one, though the twins are Swedish.
Yes.
So this starts on a motorway.
Yeah, and this one's kind of, it's relatively recent. You know, with the 17th of May, 2008. And a film crew for a documentary series called Motorway Cops is actually out on their routine shoot.
Hmm.
So they are, you know, their kind of job there is to film things and catch, you know, bad drivers or whatever else is good content for there. And what they find is something really, really strange. They see two women walking on the motorway, not beside it or in the hard shoulder, physically on the lane and the motorway. In the fast lane. Their names are Ursula and Sabina Eriksson, and they are Swedish twins, both 40 years old. They've arrived in the UK from Ireland, where Sabina lived with her husband and children. They boarded a National Express coach from Liverpool to London, but not long into the journey, they began behaving pretty strange. They refused to let staff touch their bags or put them away, and they became agitated, whispering to each other with increased urgency. So it seemed like they were smuggling something or they didn't want somebody to be aware of what they were doing. So The driver of the bus actually pulled over into a service station on the M6 and asked them to get off, which explains how they ended up here at the motorway.
Right.
And then they walked onto it. Police officers are called and arrive, and the footage shows two calm-looking women in ordinary clothes standing in traffic. But while officers are trying to coax them back into the hard shoulder, and they seem to be fine, not afraid, not anything like that, there is this remarkable moment and a very disturbing piece of footage where Ursula suddenly veers away from the cops and runs directly into the path of a lorry. She's hit and injured, thrown across the carriageway. And then while officers try to rush to her aid, Sabina then runs the opposite way into another car. So this is intentional into fast-moving traffic. Now, remarkably, both twins survive. Sabina is the less seriously injured one, and she's brought to the hard shoulder. She's calm. This is crucial. She answers questions. She makes jokes with the paramedics, and she seems to be reasonably well presented and engaging with other people. Again, toxicology tests run nothing. So no alcohol, no drugs in either of the women's systems. No explanation for why they had suddenly made this decision to run into oncoming traffic. The bags that they had been protective of were opened, and inside they find a passport and several mobile phones, which is kind of dodgy. Maybe they were trading things or, you know. But Sabina is taken off to hospital, assessed, and she is released because she doesn't seem to be that injured. And she's cooperating, as I said, with the police. She's pleading guilty to trespassing on the motorway and assaulting a police officer. She's given a day's custody, considered served, and a psychiatric evaluation is booked but not completed. She's free to go. But she has nowhere to go. As I said, they'd only come into the UK from Ireland for a brief trip, purpose of which is unknown. She's nowhere to go and in a strange city, and a sister who's still in hospital. She ends up meeting a local man named Glenn Holinshed. He sees her in kind of a distressed state and decides to take her in. So he brings her into his home, feeds her and gives her somewhere to sleep. But the next morning, she wakes up and stabs him. And Glenn dies from his injuries. She stabs him multiple times, seemingly out of nowhere. She is found shortly afterwards, smashing her own head against the road surface repeatedly. So she's arrested, charged with manslaughter and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Ultimately, she only serves half of that because of this sort of, she was given, pleaded guilty to diminished responsibility because she was deemed to be psychiatrically unwell at the time. And even though by the trial she had recovered, she was still only sentenced to 5 years. So the interesting thing about this case is this is well regarded as a case of folie à deux, which is like the crazy of two. And it's where like a psychiatric episode is somewhat contagious, especially between close people. Could explain what happened between June and Jennifer as well. There's a few charted cases of this throughout some of the crimes that I like to read in my spare time. But this is a very prime example of it, because the folie à deux here is usually only happens when people are together. And one of the interesting details about this is that when Sabina is separated and dealt with on the side of the road with the cops and in the aftermath of going to the hospital, she seems to have escaped that sort of psychosis or that folly that was happening. And typically when that has happened and the people in experiencing this state are separated, it all goes back to normal. But the aftermath of her running into traffic, being okay, getting out, but then going on to kill Glenn. It's just, it's a really weird pattern in this particular story.
Yeah. Now, what happened to Ursula?
Ursula spent 3 months in a psychiatric facility and recovered, and she never has spoken publicly about what happened. So again, we don't have any sort of understanding of what might have triggered this episode, but she went on to live a relatively normal life. And Sabina was actually only in prison for a very short time. So she was released in around 2011.
Okay.
So, I don't know, maybe they're just back to normal Christmas cards and matching jumpers. I have no idea. But again, they kind of live a quiet life. And they were, Sabina was found to have diminished responsibility and to be mentally unwell at the time. I think the real tragedy in this case was that they should have completed that psychiatric report before they released her from the hospital. And she wouldn't then have ended up encountering Glenn.
And at any stage during this, did they ever give an explanation of why they did what they did on the M6?
No, once again. But I think maybe they don't know why they did what they did. It seemed to be this shared delusion, this kind of, this real intense overwhelming need to run into the traffic that is inexplicable to even those who've done it.
Yeah. Did they, were they, when they were separated then after that, were they distressed at being separated?
No, these two, I mean, lived a relatively normal life. Like, Sabina was a mother. She had, you know, she was married, she was settled in Ireland. They seemed to be able to exist separately. They were close, but there was none of this kind of codependency that we saw with June and Jennifer.
How odd. Mm. How very strange. And we don't know where they are now, or if they're still alive.
We don't know where they are now. I'm not sure. I mean, Sabina, if she's living in Ireland, could be listening.
Yeah. Hi, Sabina. If you'd like to call in and let us know what the hell was going on there. Right. Our third set of twins. This is again, it's weird, but it's also, well, it's actually a little unsettling as what it might say about
nature versus nature.
Absolutely. So yeah. This is in the States.
This is in the States. These are two brothers. This is Robert and Stephen Spakowski. And this is one of those, one of those questions. You've got two people, identical DNA, same parents, same upbringing. They're in New York, same childhood, same neighborhood. They aren't as close as the girls that we've seen in the previous two stories, but they are pretty, you know, they are quite close. But what happens here is, unbeknownst to each other, they both go down the same path of becoming killers. So Stephen killed first. This is in 1971 when he's just 17 years old. A store owner named Ronald Ripley is struck with a hammer and stabbed. Stephen immediately pleads guilty to manslaughter. He goes to prison. He gets out. He goes back in. And this is a pattern that kind of repeats throughout his entire life. Incarceration, release, armed robbery. There are drugs involved here and there does seem to be some addiction issues. Robert, the other brother, is living as he kind of typically, as you would expect with someone in the grips of addiction. He has robbing frequently. He kind of tries to stay off the radar. But then in 1990, so a good, you know, a good 21 years or 11 years, sorry, after his brother kills, Robert also kills four times. First is a sex worker who strangled with an electrical cord. Next is his girlfriend choked to death with his bare hands. Then a businessman who's beaten. And Vivian, his friend, who he killed whilst in the grip of a kind of drug-induced delusion. But what is really interesting about this case is that after Robert killed Vivian, he bathed her body and put her down in a basement where it was kind of cooler, so to stave off sort of any
decomposition.
And while she was there, he visited her regularly to cry and apologize. And he told investigators that he kept going back because he wasn't ready to stop saying sorry. But a detail that he did not know is in the crime 11 years prior, his brother Stephen, when he killed Ronald Ripley, he did something very similar in that he sat with the body and repeatedly spoke to it and apologized to him for killing him. A detail that wasn't released publicly as part of any investigations. And once Stephen was kind of in prison, Robert and Stephen weren't really in contact much with each other. They had never shared this detail. They'd never compared notes. They had not coordinated their crimes or their guilt or their methods. They had simply just independently both arrived at the same path. So in November 2005, the guilt obviously became overwhelming for Robert and he walked into a police station in Rochester, New York and confessed to the four murders. He didn't have to. There was no forensic net closing around him and there was no mad investigation that was pointing in the direction of Robert. He just simply came clean and told them. And at this time, Stephen was serving time in Attica. And a corrections officer went up to him, brought him a newspaper with his brother's face on the front. And his response was to say, "I thought I was the only murderer in the family." Isn't that mad?
Isn't that mad?
Ultimately, the two brothers ended up in the same prison, two identical men, each in matching outfits, which are banned for adult twins. We'll have to allow it here. Each serving decades for killing, each apparently unaware of the other's capacity for it until they were reunited in prison. So Robert was sentenced to over 100 years for life. He got kind of four consecutive 25-year sentences. So he's still in prison. And Stephen was eventually released. He has given interviews, but he's kind of in those interviews. He's clean now and he's sober and he talks about the guilt that he has for his crimes, but he's still carrying a lot of guilt around it. So it still begs the question of, is it nature versus nurture, or is it something else?
And I assume there must have been fleets of psychologists, etc., coming and wanting to interview them.
Yes, they've been interviewed multiple times. There's been loads of kind of documentaries and things done about these guys.
Yeah. How bizarre and totally unsettling. Cassie Delaney, thanks a million.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. Back in a minute.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.